Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York City is Roxana Robinson, the author of Dawson's Fall, a novel. Ms. Robinson, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you so much.
In your introduction, you note that this is the story of your great-grandfather, Captain Frank Dawson. Down here in South Carolina, we like to connect people, so connect yourself back to Captain Dawson, if you would, please.
My father, Stuyvesant Barry, was born in New York. His mother was Ethel Morgan Dawson Barry, and she was the daughter of Frank Dawson. And she grew up in Charleston and was married in Charleston in 1899, and then moved to New York.
You also mention that you have family diaries and letters and so forth. As a historian, that just fascinates me. Are they in Charleston? Are they in the possession of the family, or where are they?
They're almost all at Duke University. And I think it was in the 1940s that my great uncle, the other child of Frank Dawson, Francis Warrington Dawson Jr., he was living in Versailles, and he became the object of a lot of scholarly interest, and he wrote some articles. And I think it was at that time, and he did a long interview with a scholar, a historian that was planning to write a biography of Dawson. And I think it was at that time that he gave or sold the family papers to Duke. So they are now at the Rubenstein Library there, which is an extraordinary resource for scholars. And there are boxes and boxes and boxes of material.
With your experience as a biographer as well as a writer of fiction, and all of that material, why did you choose to set this as fiction as opposed to a biography or just a frank historical report?
It's a really good question, and I went back and forth on that subject. Since I wrote the biography of Georgia O'Keeffe, I'm familiar with that form, and I know its strengths and its limitations. And the strengths, it seemed to me, was to be able to cite historical documents and to rely on the historical facts. But the problem with biography or of any historical document is you can't give the dialogue. You can't give people's thoughts. And those are things that sort of illuminate and vivify any book. So I decided to do both and make it into a hybrid form. So I've chosen to quote directly from documents. And those documents, the places where I quote are always in a different font. And the sources are cited so that you could look it up. But the voices in this story are so remarkable to me. The editorials, there's some congressional testimony given in the 1870s. There are diaries and letters, and I really wanted those voices to be part of this story. But I also wanted to write dialogue, because it's in dialogue and somebody's interior thoughts where you can really feel the person living. You can feel the person connecting to the world, saying things and hearing answers that change action. You can't do that in a biography. You can't put in scenes of wonderful conversation, because no one knows exactly what was said. If somebody says, he said such and such, you know that they're paraphrasing. You know they're just saying what they remember. So that wonderful, quick, illuminating, living exchange that we have in real dialogue is absent from a biography. So I sort of created a hybrid form, and we're calling it a biographical novel. Everything in it is true.
I do know the story of the case, and I must say, as I went through the novel, those last few days, I felt like I was there.
I'm so glad to hear that. That's a wonderful thing for a writer to hear. Thank you.
In fact, the last few chapters, I almost wanted to grab Dr. McDowell, and we'll explain who that is, and say, you can't do this.
Yeah, he's really something.
So, first of all, I think we might as well let people know. I mean, there's no doubt as to how the story ends. I mean, South Carolinians more or less know that Captain Frank Dawson, who was editor of the News and Courier, and actually with his partner, he created that newspaper by merging several Charleston papers, is shot and killed by his next-door neighbor. It was a cause célèbre, and you go through the trial, and for a newspaper editor to be shot on the streets of Charleston, and a very prominent individual, not just in Charleston, but the entire South. He, along with the editor of the Atlanta Constitution, the Louisville Courier-Journal, was one of the champions of what people called the New South. Industry will be what will bring the South back, not growing more cotton. And that's a story, again, that you weave in there very, very nicely.
Thank you. It's such a wonderful, rich, complicated story.
Let's go back and to England, where Frank Dawson is from. And first of all, he wasn't born Frank Dawson.
No. His story is like something out of Dickens. It's so complicated and so melodramatic. But this is a family story, and it seems to be true. When he was 19 or 20, he was a journalist in London, and he read about the Civil War, which was just beginning, and he and England and the South were trading partners and economic allies, and England presented the South as a group of brave little states that were standing up to a northern bully. And Dawson, who was not named that then, said to his father, "I think I'm going to go over and help those southern states stand up to the North." And his father said, "What do you mean? You don't know. How would you get there?" And Dawson says, "Well, there's a Confederate ship in Southampton, and I have a letter to the captain." And his father says, "Well, you don't know how to sail." And he says, "That would be true of anyone. But I can learn." And his father said, "Well, you shouldn't do it. Those southern ships are going around and burning ships on the high seas, and that's piracy. And if you're caught, you'll be hanged as a pirate, and you'll disgrace the family name, and I forbid it." And Frank Dawson said, "Well, then I won't use the family name." And his father said, "What are you talking about? What would you use?" And he said, I'll take a nom de guerre. I'll call myself Francis after my saint's name," he was a Catholic, "and Warrington after a cousin, and Dawson after my aunt who put me through school." And right on the spot, he changed his name, and he lived for the rest of his life as Francis Warrington Dawson.
And did the family back in England, did they keep in touch after the war? Or
absolutely. They were actually a very close family, and that dramatic incident makes it sound as though Frank was someone who would walk away from his father, but it's not true. We have, in that archive at Duke, we have all his letters to his family in London, all during the Civil War, which is a wonderful document. And he went back after the war and visited them often, and he was very close to them.
I admire him as a man of principle, but he was also a little bit impetuous, and he was impetuous really throughout his career.
Yes, he was. That's a really good point. It was a strength and a weakness. He believed that he could do things with energy and dedication, and it served him very well in most instances. But it meant that he was impatient, and he wasn't always willing to listen. And at the end of his life, his partner, Reardon, who was really a wonderful source of strength and restraint in his life and intelligence, his partner left and moved to New York. And I think that was part of what was the cause of his decline, the decline of the paper. Right, he was somebody who was impetuous.
So he's on a ship headed to the Confederacy. Let's pick up the story there.
So he gets on the ship, and he's thrilled that this is an adventure. And his best friend had gone off to the Foreign Legion. So this is sort of what Dawson is doing. He talks his way onto the ship. The captain didn't really think he was going to show up. The captain said, "I'm sorry, we can't take you." And Dawson says, "Well, could you take me as a passenger?" And the captain says, "No, this is a military ship. It's a naval ship. We don't take passengers." And he said, "Could I come as a junior officer?" And he says, "No, you didn't go to our naval academy. The only thing I could offer you would be to go as a member of the crew, and you wouldn't do that." And Dawson says, "Yes, I will. I'll come as a member of the crew." And the captain didn't want him to come as a member of the crew. The crew were all older. They were from all over the world. They were kind of villainous, and he didn't think it was suitable at all for this young man who knows nothing about sailing to be stuck among the members of the crew who have to climb the rigging and to actually run the ship. But Dawson shows up when the captain is not there and says to the man in charge, he said, well, the captain's waiting for me. I'm a member of the crew. And he goes down below and becomes a member of the crew. But at that point, the ship is still ashore. They're waiting for something. And so he spends, so they get a lot of shore leave. And during the shore leave, he spends a lot of time with the young officers who are his age and from his, a similar background. They're all educated. And he becomes friends with them. And when the ship leaves and sets out across the ocean, the captain sees him and brings him up to a higher deck and gives him a stateroom with another, with an engineer. And so he becomes friends with all these young men from Confederate backgrounds, plantation owners' sons. And it's they who give him his education, his preliminary education in how the South, what the South is like, what the culture is like. And it would be completely new to Dawson. Slavery is a part of it. England had banned slavery 30 years earlier, and it was a big part of the Confederacy. So he would have learned about all the cultural aspects of the South from his friends on ship. And by the time he gets he reaches America, he's good friends with all of them. And the captain has taken a great fancy to him. And when they arrive, everyone is given shore leave because they've been on this long journey. And the captain knows that Dawson has nowhere to go. And the captain invites him home to stay with his family. And this is a man called Pegram. And it's this way that in which Dawson becomes knitted into the network of friendship and kinship that operates throughout the South. And so all these people were his friends, and Pegram really took him on as a sort of a son. And then he meets a neighbor, a man called Nathaniel Rains, who literally took Dawson on and said, "I want you to treat me as your father. I will you use this house as your home. Come here whenever you have leave. Ask me for anything you need." He was very taken by the gallantry of a young man who would come and offer his life for the Confederacy.
All right. And where did they make port when they got to the Confederacy?
It's a little obscure to me because they came in, they tricked a northern boat, and they came into one port, but then they were talking about another port. It's not quite clear to me.
Okay.
But they where he went with Pegram was Virginia.
Okay. He then abandons the sea for the land, correct, and gets into the Confederate service?
Yes. Well, he first is in the Confederate Navy, and he serves under Pegram. He's outside Richmond on a terrible ship without an engine, without a mast. And then he's called by Captain Pegram to go down to New Orleans, where they're assigned to a ship. But by the time they get there, the ship has been sunk in the Battle of New Orleans, and they're sent back to Richmond. And at that point, maybe that's when he gets assigned to the ship without an engine or a mast. He realizes the Confederate Navy is no longer a driving force, and so he resigns from that and joins the cavalry under Captain Pegram's nephew, who's Willie Pegram. So he serves in that, and his first battle is the Battle of Mechanicsville.
All right. He serves throughout the war. He's wounded.
Wounded twice.
And he does rise to the rank of captain. That's not an assumption. He really did earn the rank.
He really did.
Okay. And he's in Richmond when the war ends.
Yes. Yes, he's been wounded. He was wounded in the shoulder, and he was brought back from the battlefield to a house in Richmond. And he's lying in a darkened room with his shoulder bound, and he's recovering. And he hears noises outside in the streets, and there are shouts, and there are the sound of wagons and some shots. And there's no one with him. He's lying there trying to imagine what's going on outside in the streets. And it sounds very dramatic. And he thinks, oh, Richmond has fallen. This is terrible. Richmond has fallen. But it wasn't Richmond. It was the Confederacy. That was the end of the war.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about the reason that Dawson came over. He came over to defend what he considered states' rights. But as you pointed out earlier, that obviously slavery is part of the Confederacy's story.
Yes, but it wouldn't have been part of the story that the press was giving out in England. As I say, they were trading partners, and so what was important to them was that they keep this economic alliance going. But I think, Dawson wrote his memoirs called Memoirs of a Confederacy Soldier, and in that he says that he wrote it 20 years after the fact. So he didn't remember exactly, but he said he thinks that he thought the Southern states were like the brave barons standing up to King John and demanding the Magna Carta. So that's exactly the way the South was presenting itself, as a question of states' rights. But I looked back and saw that also right at the moment when he was talking about this to his father about this, there was a famous incident, and he must have known that, although he may have forgotten about it when he wrote his memoir. And that was when two Confederate agents, Slidell and Green, were sent from the Confederacy to England in order to try to persuade England to enter the battle on their side, which, of course, would have been wonderful for the Confederacy if England had agreed to do that. And so this was a very important mission that they were on. And they boarded an English packet ship. And for some reason, instead of going directly to England, the ship went down to the Bahamas. And the Union soldiers knew about this, knew that Slidell and Green were on that ship, and they stopped the ship, seized it, and they took Slidell and Green off and took them to prison in Boston. This caused a huge international uproar because the Confederacy claimed that this was against international maritime law. You can't seize another ship. England said the same thing. You can't seize another country's ship. The North said, the Union said, this is sedition. It's illegal. These are criminals. And we have every right to take them prisoner. So that was, it never really got anywhere. Nobody did anything further. Slidell and Green were put in prison. But that issue was enormous, and people took vehement positions on it. And that was right at the time when Dawson said to his father, I want to go and fight for the Confederacy. So I think that played a part in it, although in his recollections, he said it was the barons standing up to King John.
That affair of the seizing of the two Confederate agents actually into the English press played into this idea of the gallant chivalric South versus these big bullies from the North.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, we've gotten to the end of the war, and he is in Richmond. What is he going to do? Is he going to go back home to England?
He considers that. He's penniless at the end of the war, and he makes a joke about it, and he says, I had a $5 bill that a cousin from Maryland sent me, and I changed it into change so it would look as though I had more money. And he looked for work. He looked for anything. He tried to get a job driving a dray, a wagon. He worked for an express company, which went bust. And he had finally agreed to go back and manage the plantation of Nathaniel Rains. After the war, obviously, all the plantations had to change their modus operandi. So he was going to help, even though, just as he'd never known how to sail a ship, but he volunteered to become a sailor. He'd never run a plantation, but he thought he would do this. But during the war, or just after it, he and a friend had started a little newspaper in Richmond, which had been closed down by the federal agents because they were kind of insolent and mocking towards the federal presence, and so it had been closed down. But he had already started doing some journalism, which he had done in London. And just as he was about to leave to go off to take care of the plantation, he got a telegram from the friend in Richmond saying, come here to Richmond and we'll start a paper. And so that was Reardon. And the two of them worked in a paper in Richmond together. And then it was Reardon who had a physical disability. He limped, and so he had not fought in the war, but he had been in Charleston reporting, and he remembered Charleston, and he said, you and I should go to Charleston and start a paper. The papers there are old-fashioned, and they need something new. And I'll go first, I'll get myself a job, and then I'll find you a job, and you come second, and we will start a paper. And that's what they did. And that's what is kind of wonderful about Dawson and Reardon too, but they just believed they could make a plan and they could make it work. And when they got to Charleston, when they were in Richmond, they lived in the office. They lived in the back of the office, and they had their meals at a hotel, and they worked 24 hours a day. They just did nothing but work. And he did the same thing when he came to Charleston. He just dug in, and he loved it. He loved the idea of founding a paper. He loved the idea of bringing new ideas. He loved Charleston, and he was convinced that he was the man to bring it into the modern world.
Well, and of course, one of the most influential papers in South Carolina and the American South prior to the Civil War was the Charleston Mercury, run by and managed by the Rhett family, who were completely unreconstructed and bitter after the war, and continued to not want to, through the Mercury, not want to accept the reality of what had happened and ended at Appomattox. And that's what you, when you were talking about Dawson and Reardon, understood that Charleston was ready for an up-to-date newspaper, one that was going to deal with the reality of a defeated South and its attempted recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dawson's first job in Charleston was at the Mercury, and he worked for the Rhetts. And as you say, they were completely unreconstructed. They were furious that the war had ended as it had. They had a huge investment in the South the way it had been before the war. And Dawson went in 1866, right after the war had ended, and went into the office of the editor, old Mr. Rhett, and said to him, "We should swallow the amendment that allows black people to vote. We should just accept it." And he was a good newspaper man. He said, first of all, it's the law, and secondly, it will be the making of the newspaper, and that's what we should do. And you can imagine how old Mr. Rhett felt about this 25-year-old Englishman coming into his office and telling him what to do about the New South. He almost fired him on the spot. But Dawson was looking into the future, and Rhett was looking into the past.
All right, and so he and Reardon, on their own, found a newspaper. Now, where did they get the capital to do that?
Good question. They borrowed money. They went all over Charleston to borrow money. They first bought the News, and then they later bought the Courier. But it was a quite exciting story, and he tells it. By now, this is in the early 1870s, and by now he has met Sarah, so we have his letters to her describing what happened. And he went around Charleston going to banks and laying out his case, saying that he and his partner had plans and they would absolutely make this a going venture. And at the last minute, this was a moribund paper at the News at the time, and at the last minute, Charleston realized that these two outsiders were buying a very distinguished old Charleston paper, and they made moves to block him from doing it, from borrowing the money. And in the end, he borrowed some of the money from his father-in-law. He was married before he married Sarah. And they also found a silent partner in New York, he and Reardon. So they came up to New York and persuaded this third partner that this would be a valuable investment. So the three of them together ended up owning the News, and then they bought the Courier.
All right. Roxana, we need to pause a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Roxana Robinson about her novel, Dawson's Fall. It's a true story, but it's written as a novel, and it is about Captain Frank Dawson, co-founder of the News and Courier in Charleston. So, Roxana, back to the story. These two outsiders, Dawson and his partner, are able to get the money to start the newspaper. They revive the News and eventually buy the Courier and become the News and Courier. And that's what the newspaper remains, the title, until the late 20th century.
Yes. Yes, it's a very vigorous paper and still survives.
From the very beginning, he was willing to take stands. You've already talked about his discussion with the Rhetts about we've got to accept the 13th and 14th Amendments. And that was the kind of political viewpoint, even during Reconstruction, that he took. You obeying the law. He advocated for African Americans to be on juries. a sadly ironic twist on that at the very end. But because he was impetuous, and you have some wonderful examples of that, it helped to have a cooler head as a co-partner. Having dealt with editors before, as you have, Reardon would make corrections. Sometimes he'd X the whole thing out. Sometimes he'd say yes. And you pointed at one point, he just wrote a big N-O on an editorial that Dawson had intended to publish.
Yeah, they were good partners. And Dawson, for anyone who has ever been a writer, the idea of writing an editorial every day for 20 years is just an amazing kind of feat. And it makes you... anyone who's written a journal or tried to keep a diary, it's hard to come up with new ideas every day. He didn't write an editorial every single day, and there were other people that wrote them, but he was the main voice, and he wrote all the time. And so what that means is that you become very quick in your responses, and you don't edit yourself as much as you would if you only wrote a column once a week. So he is setting down his thoughts on things, and he's often impulsive. And so it was good for him to have Reardon saying that, oh, I don't think we should really say that right now, and you're going to stir up a hornet's nest. Sometimes it was worth it. Frank Dawson believed in the rule of law, and that put him at cross purposes with some members of the Confederacy who thought the new laws were wrong. And Dawson stood up for the rule of law, and he believed that principle was the way to lead your life. And so sometimes that made him a hero, and sometimes it made him the object of pure rage from all the people that he was so close to, the people with whom he'd fought during the war. But he came from a different country, and he approached things with a different set of principles.
You mentioned Sarah, and he was married twice. Let's talk about Sarah's background, because that certainly has an influence on later events.
Sarah was born in Baton Rouge to a judge and his wife, who was also named Sarah. Sarah was called Sarah Fowler Morgan. Her father was a very distinguished judge and successful lawyer. She was the seventh of eight children. And her father had been born in Princeton, New Jersey, and had sailed down the Mississippi with his brother, and they'd gotten off in Baton Rouge, and they both married planters' daughters and became part of that society. Baton Rouge was a place where it had been part of the Louisiana Purchase, and it was a place where everyone spoke French. So French was a second language in that family. And it was a family that valued education. Everyone in it was educated, though none of the girls went to school. Part of the way the family worked was the older children taught the younger children, and every morning, as a young woman, Sarah and her sister went and gave lessons to their nieces and nephews. And Sarah was highly educated and had read Gibbon and the philosophers and Shakespeare. And so it was a family that valued education and valued principle, and her brothers were lawyers, and her favorite brother was a doctor who, just as the war was beginning, had come back from France, where he'd been studying medicine. So they were not landowners, but they were, like many families in the South, utterly brought to their knees by the war. Her father died, nothing to do with the war, but he died just before the war began. He had opposed secession. He had supported the Union, but he died of an asthma attack. And then 6 months later, her favorite brother, Henry, the one who'd been studying in Paris, came back, and because of an argument late at night with another man in Baton Rouge, he had been challenged to a duel. Without telling the family, without telling Sarah, he went down to New Orleans because it was illegal to have duels in Baton Rouge. He stayed with his older half-brother who lived in New Orleans, and went out to the Oaks with the man who challenged him, whose name was Sparks. They had their seconds, and they stood under the oaks in the early morning. It was raining, and the two of them had their weapons, and the seconds called out the moment and called out the paces, and they each walked away from each other, And they turned around, and the seconds called, ready, aim, fire, and Mr. Sparks shot Henry Morgan in the chest. And he died later that afternoon. And that was the most devastating second blow to that family. First their father, and then their favorite son, Sarah's favorite.
And you've got Sarah's journals and letters, and clearly that had a tremendous impact on her.
Tremendous. He was the person she was closest to in the family. So they started off the war with having lost their two central men. And there were three other brothers, all of whom went into the war, and two of them were killed. So it was a family very greatly diminished.
So how did Frank Dawson meet Sarah Morgan?
It's a great Southern story. So by then, her youngest brother, Jem, who was incredibly adventurous and moved around the world like a spinning top, he had been at Annapolis when the war began, and he and the other Southern students left and to go back home and join the Confederacy. He was in the Confederate Navy for the war, and he was in the Battle of New Orleans. And then at the end of it, and he, during the war, he came down with yellow fever because of a series of incidents. He was nursed back to health by George Trenum, who was the Secretary of the Treasury of the Confederacy.
And from South Carolina.
From South Carolina, for reasons I won't go into here, but that's where he ended up. Trenum was incredibly generous and hospitable. So Jem ended up recuperating in the Trenum house, in the beautiful Trenum house. And, of course, he fell in love with one of Trenum's daughters. It was Helen, the beautiful one. And at the end of the war, he came back and asked for her hand. And they married. And a year later, they had a daughter, Emily. And right after that, his wife died of yellow fever. Jem went off to live in Egypt. And he came back and after 6 years, and decided to buy a plantation and run it. Trenum helped him. And he was out near Columbia on a place called Hamptons that he was trying to run. He knew nothing about running a plantation. And he had a friend who took him to lunch one day in Columbia, and they ran into a pair of men who were having a political feud and who both were armed. And there was a shootout in the restaurant. And Jem Morgan was shot in the shoulder and taken home, and the wound became infected. And Sarah and her mother had come up to live with him at that point. They had the house in Baton Rouge was gone. And they came to live with Jem and help him run the plantation, and he was dying. And Sarah sent a telegram to his friend whom he'd met, Jem and Dawson had met coming back from the Battle of New Orleans when New Orleans fell, and they were both retreating Confederate soldiers on the same train to Richmond. So they knew each other. They had known each other from during the war. And Sarah sent a telegram to this friend of Jem's. He said, go get Dawson. Get him to come here. Dawson took the train up to Columbia, and it stopped at Hampton's plantation. And he went up to the house, not knowing what had happened, not knowing if Jem was still alive. And the door of the house opened, and a woman stepped out onto the porch. And she said, he will live. And Dawson looked at her and thought, this is the woman I'm meant to marry, though he was already married.
Okay, he was already married at the time.
He was married at the time. He had been married for 5 years. He had married a lovely young woman called Virginia Forgeau, but she had gotten tuberculosis, and she had been dying for 4 years. There was nothing you could do about tuberculosis at that time, and everyone was watching her die. It was a terrible situation.
So, but he sees this angel and knows that they're going to get married, right? That's what he says.
He says, he doesn't know he's going to get married, but he thinks, this is the person God meant for me to marry. That just comes into his head.
Okay. And his first wife does die.
She dies 3 months later. And he was very devoted to her. He was a very loyal husband and took care of her and lived with her parents and lived with them for several years afterwards.
How long before he married Sarah?
I think it's a year and a half. But he meets Sarah in September. His wife dies in December. In January or February, he writes to Sarah and asks her permission to write to her. So it proceeds very slowly. After September, he starts visiting Jem as Jem is recuperating. And, of course, each time he visits Jem, he sees Sarah. At the same time, his wife is in the last stages. And he's very loyal to her. He tells Sarah all about her. He shows her Sarah her photograph. Sarah becomes a sort of a distant friend of Virginia's, and they're all aware of this passage of grief that Dawson is going through. But afterwards, he asks formal permission to write to Sarah, and she understands what that means, and she says, well, I'm not sure that I want you to write to me, but I'll make a rule. You must write three letters to me before I'll answer you, before I'll send you one. And he says, done. If that's fine, you'll get so many letters, you can't believe it. So they start writing, and several months after that, he asks her to marry him, and she says, no, I won't even think about it. We don't know each other well enough, and I never wanted to get married anyway. My plan was always to take care of one of my brothers. And by this time, Jem has remarried, and there is no brother that she needs to take care of. And Dawson says, I want to take care of you. And she has her mother with her, and she says, well, I need to take care of my mother. And he says, she will always have a home with us. And she says, well, I'm not going to talk about it for 6 months. For 6 months, we can get to know each other. And so they write constantly, Dawson more than she, for 6 months. And then he writes her another letter, which is very moving, and I put it in the book, that says, I have shown you my devotion. I think you know who I am. I think I know who you are. And it would give me the greatest pleasure to join my life with yours. And at that point, she agrees, but they don't get married until the following January or February.
Why did they decide they needed to hire a European governess for their children?
When Dawson was a child in England, it was very common in upper middle class families to send your children away to boarding school at very early ages, at six often. So he was sent away at six, and then he was sent away to a high school boarding school called St. Mary's. And it was run by a famous headmaster. It was incredibly challenging, and it was a wonderful school. He loved it. And he learned Latin, Greek, French, Italian and German. He was a wonderful linguist. He could read music. He was very widely read as a scholar. And so he believed in that kind of education. He said it didn't exist in America. They weren't that kind of boarding school that was demanding and challenging and furnished a classical education like the one that he had received. So he wanted his children to go to boarding school in England or France. And Sarah said, as an American mother, these children are too young to send away to boarding school. If we're going to send them to boarding school in Europe, I'm going with them. So it was a painful decision for both of them, but they couldn't find a school in Charleston or in the South that met their standards. So Sarah took the children and moved to Europe for a couple of years, and Dawson visited them regularly. They came home regularly, and they both wanted the children to grow up speaking French because Sarah had spoken it at home. It was her language of family, and Dawson spoke it perfectly and loved it. And they wanted their children to speak it. So when they were over there, Dawson wrote to Sarah and said, if you find a personable young woman that can look after the children who speaks French, bring her home so that we can have French be the family language, the language we speak at home. So she went to an employment agency in Lausanne, Switzerland, and found a Swiss girl who spoke French and who was 22 years old and very pleasant. They liked her very much. And her name was Marie-Hélène Bourderon, difficult name to say. And they brought her home. And she lived with them for the next 2 years.
And that's where the story really heats up, because the next door neighbor, Dr. McDowell, who didn't have a great reputation to begin with, spies this beautiful young French. He calls her a French woman, and in the press later on, she sort of almost described as the French maid, which of course she wasn't. She was a governess. One thing leads to another, and I'll let you pick it up there.
Yeah, it was sort of a terrible attraction between two people who should never have been connected. But McDowell was an unstable personality. He'd already been in some legal trouble. He lived just across the fence, the side fence from the Dawsons. He had one daughter. He was married. His father-in-law was rich, was a rich grocer. McDowell was sort of just on the loose, and I think he was drinking all the time, and he may have been taking some kind of medical drugs as well. He was quite unsteady, and he was called in to look at the child of the cook, the Dawson's cook, and that's when he met Hélène. And he was an unsavory creature. He was having an affair with a childhood friend of his wife, a woman called Julia Smith, who was well known in Charleston. And Julia was a sort of housekeeper, but sort of just best friend. And she spent a lot of time at the McDowell household. And she had a room of her own on the third floor where McDowell would visit her. And he was promising to her that he would marry her. He'd leave his wife and run off with her. So he'd already established himself as a man of complete lack of principle, lack of honesty. And he saw Hélène and was charmed by the fact that she was French and that she was so nearby. And he started watching her on the street. She took the children to school every morning, and he was outside on the sidewalk watching them and saying good morning and speaking to her. He brought her flowers. And he pursued her. And she was young. She spoke very poor English, so it was sort of fun for her to speak in broken English to this charming man who seemed to find her so attractive. Because she spoke French and Charleston wasn't a French-speaking community, she didn't really have much way to get into the community. So this was very appealing to her, and this was someone who found her beautiful. So he just pursued her, met her, asked her to meet him late at night in the garden, asked her to bring him inside the Dawson's house, and he became more and more urgent. And it became more and more dangerous as the servants watched this happen, and everyone knew that if the Dawsons found out what was going on, there would be an explosion.
Dawson does hear about it, and he hires a private detective.
He doesn't hire a private detective. Somebody sends him a poison pen letter and says, "Do you know what's going on? Your family is being disgraced by the behavior of this young woman." And he goes to the police chief, who's a friend of his, and he says, "What do you know about this? Would you put a plainclothesman on my governess to see if this is true?" The police chief says yes, and he sends a plainclothesman after her and finds out that she is seeing this neighbor. And the police chief says, "Don't confront him. He's dangerous. There's a rumor that he's already shot someone and killed them in Tennessee. Don't take this on yourself." But Dawson is not a man who listens to advice, and he's impetuous.
And so he does confront McDowell in McDowell's house with tragic results.
Yes. And at this point in Dawson's life, things are closing in on him. He is fearful for the survival of his paper because this rival paper is taking away his staff and his customers. And he's not certain now that he can make things right. He has always believed before in his life he's been able to make things right by hard work and determination. And things are not going his way, but this is one thing he can solve. And Dawson, by virtue of his own energy, always thinks he's right. He thinks he's right about everything. But also, in this case, he's outraged because McDowell is such a snake. He's being so so deceitful. He's already got a wife and a mistress, and he's taking on this young unmarried woman who is under Dawson's protection. And so Dawson also feels that his own honor is impugned as well as poor Hélène's. So he challenges McDowell on all these levels. But McDowell doesn't live on that plane. He doesn't pay any attention to principle or integrity or the law. And I think, as I say, I think he drinks all the time, and he's had a very bad day that day anyway. And he's upset, and he's been drinking. And he gets a pistol out of his drawer. And as Dawson's leaving, he shoots him.
And this is where it almost becomes like a soap opera. Dawson's dead in his front hall, and he buries him under the floor. Under the floorboards.
It's madness.
Then, of course, there is a trial, and McDowell is acquitted. And this is one of the ironies I mentioned earlier, is that Dawson had advocated allowing African-American men to serve on juries. And although he had been, for his day, a progressive new Southerner, in the year or so preceding this event, he had written some editorials that greatly upset the African-American community. And McDowell's defense attorneys used that to their advantage in gaining an acquittal.
What Dawson did, Dawson hated lynching. He hated it. He tried over and over to rouse the white population against this vile criminal activity. He wrote about lynchings whenever he found them. He said it was outrageous. He challenged the courts to prove the identities of people who had lynched. It drove him crazy. It was completely beyond the bounds of law. And as I say, he believed in the rule of law. So what happened at the end was there was a famous case of a white man raping a 12-year-old African-American girl called Lula Sherman. And this man raped her in her house in front of her younger sister when her parents were out and beat her up first. And she died of injuries the next day. The man was found, and he was taken to the sheriff's office. It was midnight by the time that they had gone through all of the legal issues, and they were going to take him by wagon to the prison. The father, Lula's father, was sort of taken charge of by a couple of white men who said, "You must respond to this. You must take action. Let's get that guy." So there was a group of them, maybe eight people, mostly African American. I think there were two whites, but there's evidence that it was the white men who started it. So they get halfway to the prison, and a man steps out and takes hold of the mule's bridle. And these men came out of the darkness and seized the prisoner and took him away. They all had guns. And the next day, the prisoner was found hanged. So it's a clear case of lynching, but it was the races were reversed. These were black men lynching a white man, which aroused a furor. The members of the community were furious that black men had lynched a white man. There was a trial, and the black men were condemned to hang for lynching, which was not what happened when white men lynched. They were let off. In fact, they weren't even taken to court. So these men were taken to court, and they were condemned to hang. And there was a letter sent around the state asking for clemency. Dawson's position, he had been trying for decades to stop lynching. He'd been railing against it. He'd been saying, "This is an outrageous miscarriage of justice. We must obey the rule of law. We cannot allow this to happen." So now when this happens, he says, "We must hang the lynchers. This is the first time we've ever had the lynchers called to account. They must be hanged." Well, this was the father of the girl who'd been raped and murdered. And to hang him for taking vengeance on her murderer when all these white men had done it with impunity seemed wrong. It seems morally wrong to us now. But what he was driven by was this need to stop lynching. So he said, if black men are hanged for lynching people, if they're put to death for lynching, then white people will understand that they will be hanged for lynching, and we will put a stop to it. So he wrote, and the day before this happened, he wrote a really offensive editorial saying that the morals of the white race held them accountable, and it's obvious that they are morally more superior to the black race. It was very offensive. And so he said something incredibly stupid, incredibly offensive, which if he had lived, he might well have walked back and reconsidered and said, this is what I'm trying to do. So that's what the last editorial was in service of, but he never had a chance to explain it. And the black community turned against him with that editorial. But it meant that his attacker, his murderer, was set free.
I hate this, Roxana, but Alfred's giving me the wind-up sign.
Oh, dear.
So are there any last words you'd like to pass on to our listeners before we sign off?
No, but thank you for giving me the opportunity to have this conversation. It's a great South Carolina story, and I love having been able to tell it.
Roxana Robinson, the author of Dawson's Fall, a novel, I want to thank you so much for being with us today on The Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know we're talking about the story of a murder, but it is an interesting story. I did enjoy reading about it. I knew the story, but putting it in fictional form and getting into the heads and the minds of the principals made for quite a different experience. This is the story of a young Englishman who became a self-adopted South Carolinian, had great influence, and then his impetuous nature, which had led to his coming to the Confederacy in the first place, led to the decline of his newspaper and to his tragic death. It is an incredible South Carolina story. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.